He was born in 1977. He was raised in a Jewish home with both parents just outside Indianapolis, Indiana. He graduated from high school and then went on to college at Indiana University. After graduating from there, he worked briefly in the revenue management department of a small airline company before he got his big break. In 1998, he was hired to be the face of a major international company. In fact, during his 13 years as their spokesman, this company's revenues tripled, and they attributed half of that growth in revenue as a direct result of this young man's promotional impact. He became a multimillionaire. He'd achieved the American dream, the perfect picture of a rags-to-riches success story. Started a foundation, a nonprofit organization that would raise money and awareness for children struggling with childhood obesity. But in 2015, when investigators started looking into the details of this foundation, they discovered that no financial grants had been issued for their intended purposes. In fact, it turns out that this celebrity was using the foundation and the director of the foundation to traffic in child pornography. And so in 2015, Jared Fogel was arrested, and eventually he made a plea deal to avoid the almost 50 years of prison that he would have faced if the case had gone to trial. And Subway, his employer, immediately broke all ties with their very famous spokesman, Jared. Now, I share this story not to throw stones at this man. I pray that Jared's situation will open him up to the forgiveness and restoration and miracle-working power of our great God. But I share it today to illustrate the importance of our question that we're going to walk through. How will I handle success? There are examples in every field, including my field, of people achieving success whose character couldn't keep pace with their talent. And the story almost always ends the same way, a pile of rubble from what once looked like an impressive edifice. Now, I understand that most of us aren't going to be faced with the temptations that go along with becoming an overnight multimillionaire like happened to Jared. Some of you are like, give me those problems any day, right? But the warning for us is very relevant. It's hard to be faithful during suffering, but it's harder still to be faithful during success. Thomas Carlyle once said, for every 100 people that can handle adversity, there's only one that can handle prosperity. We need to learn to cope with success. Now, last week we looked at how to be faithful in the waiting, in that time of struggle. And today we're going to learn about how to respond when things are going well for you. How to keep a godly perspective when things take a turn for the better. In fact, in life and with family and at work, we all want to do well. We all want to succeed. And so our big idea today is this. When climbing the ladder of success, make sure it's God's ladder. Okay? If you might not get to the top and realize that it's a dead end. Last week we learned as Joseph walked through suffering. And this week we're going to learn as he walks through success. So we'll be in Genesis 41 today. That's the very first book in the whole Bible, so it's a pretty easy one to find. You can grab whatever device you might be using. And also, I'd love you to take out your devotional guide. Hopefully, you brought that with you to page 28 today. Now, when we left Joseph last week, he was in prison, unjustly. In fact, we found out that he would spend another 2 years in prison waiting and hoping and anticipating that the little bug that he put into the ear of one of his fellow prisoners, the cupbearer, would one day make its way to Pharaoh, the most powerful man in the world at the time. Now, I said 2 years, but it's actually been 13 years since he was sold by his brothers into slavery. 13 years of nightmare, hardship, setback, and frustration. But he's about to get a break. Now, I'm going to summarize for us the first part of chapter 41 before we pick things up in verse 37. So Joseph was in the dungeon and Pharaoh's in the palace. And one night, Pharaoh has two bizarre dreams. And in his first dream, he sees seven fat cows coming out of the Nile River, and they were eaten by seven skinny cows that came out of the same river. Pharaoh awoke, and for a few minutes he considered his dream and what it meant, and then he went back to sleep. And in the second dream, he saw a stalk with seven plump heads of grain on it, and suddenly seven shriveled heads appeared that devoured the seven plump heads of grain. And he was perplexed. And so he sent for his best advisors and his best wise men, and nobody could interpret the dream. And in that moment, one of his advisors, the cupbearer, remembers Joseph from 2 years earlier. And he says, oh, yeah, well, when I was in prison, there was this guy who interpreted a dream for me. He was a Hebrew slave, and so Pharaoh calls for Joseph. Joseph gets cleaned up, and he stands before Pharaoh. Imagine the scene, an unknown Hebrew slave standing before the mightiest man in the whole world. It's his big moment. What a rise from the ashes. Now, look at verse 15 of chapter 41. It says, "And Pharaoh said to Joseph, 'I have had a dream, and there is no one who can interpret it. I have heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it.'" Verse 16, Joseph answered Pharaoh, "It is not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer." Now, this isn't our main text today, but if you're taking notes, you should just underline that last part of verse 16 where he says, "It's not in me," and write, "Keep giving God the credit," in the margin. Do you know how tempting it would have been for Joseph to try to grab a hold of the spotlight right here? I mean, this is his one big shot before a powerful and, might I add, pagan ruler. I don't know if this is exactly the time to be dropping God bombs, okay? This was like a job interview. Joseph should have said, "Pharaoh, here's what I bring to the table. I have 13 years experience interpreting dreams. I have a background in multiculturalism, right? I've learned to handle setbacks with added determination and discipline. My biggest weakness is that I work too hard." You know, don't you like that one? "You won't find a better candidate than me, Pharaoh. You should hire me on the spot." But instead, he begins by redirecting Pharaoh's attention and focus from himself to God. Wow, what a lesson. That you need to always be looking for ways to promote your God and not yourself. Now, this is particularly difficult for us to do during times of success. You know, when things start going your way, you know, it's easy to give God the credit at the begining because we needed him to get out of the pit, and we needed him to get out of the prison, and we needed him for the promotion. And so we're like, "Thank you, God, thank you, God, thank you, God," at the beginning. But a month into that new promotion, our tendency is to completely forget that God got us there. And so we start saying things like, "Look at me, look what I've accomplished. You know, I always did work a little bit harder than everyone else." For many people, as earthly success gets bigger, God gets smaller. Not Joseph. You know, this is one of the reasons that over and over again the Bible encourages thankfulness in us. It's because thankfulness is the heart attitude that constantly reminds us that all good things come from God. And so even during his big break, Joseph is grateful, and he starts by giving God all the credit. But then he goes on to interpret Pharaoh's dream. Joseph said, "Here's what it means, that these seven, you know, things." He said, "There'll be 7 years of plenty, followed by 7 years of devastating famine." And it's important, Pharaoh, that you get some great leaders around you, very disciplined leaders, who will not squander resources during the years of plenty, but instead who will put a system in place to save up the resources so that when the famine hits, the 7 years of famine, and the whole world is starving, that there will be food enough for everyone to survive, because the whole world is going to be coming to your doorstep, Pharaoh. Now, we could do a whole study right here on the importance of spiritual financial principles and saving up during prosperous times so that there's margin during difficult times, but I'll leave that for another day. But Pharaoh is so impressed by Joseph's insight that he turns around and makes him the second most powerful man in Egypt next to himself. He gives Joseph power and authority and wealth and fame. Now remember, this is a Hebrew slave who's just been released from prison. His rise to the top couldn't have been more profound. And we're left wondering, how will he handle himself now? I mean, we've seen him be faithful during suffering, but what will he do with success? This quote from Plutarch says it this way. It says, "No beast is more savage than man when possessed with power." And so what will become of Joseph? Now, one other quick note as we read this story. We have to resist the urge to look at this chapter through an American Hollywood cinematic lens. The temptation is to make this chapter about the American dream. This is the feel-good moment, right? Cue the orchestra, and the tension is released. Finally, all of Joseph's sacrifice has paid off. He's remained faithful, and so God is blessing him with fame and fortune and family. But in his book on Joseph, Vadi Bauchman Jr. insightfully points out that Genesis 41 is not Joseph's payoff. So often we read this chapter like it's the payoff. We'll read it to our kids in the little children's Bible. We'll say, see, honey, if you are faithful to God, he will make you rich and powerful in the end. No. The main point of the Joseph account, this whole story, is that God's covenant family is hanging in the balance. Jacob and the brothers, the 12 tribes. And this worldwide famine that Pharaoh has just dreamed about, it will surely lead to their extinction and the end of God's salvation story. God's promise to Abraham will have failed. God's dream of a covenant people and a promised land and a Messiah will be over. No. The payoff comes 9 chapters from now when Joseph's brothers are forgiven and the covenant family is fed and preserved and God is proven faithful again. That's the pinnacle of the story. This chapter, chapter 41, is here to remind us that in his success in this pagan nation, Egypt, Joseph is teetering on the edge of compromise. He's not at home in his Hebrew home with his family. He's in a foreign land, Egypt, that's going to tempt him in a variety of ways. And we're about to get some subtle reminders throughout this whole chapter of these kind of false parallels between Egypt and where he was supposed to be with the covenant family. I'll just share some examples. In his rise to power, you see, in Egypt, he was still a slave and not a son. Pharaoh, his master, is a pagan who is worshipped as a false god instead of the one true God at his home. Pharaoh put special garments on Joseph, a throwback to his father's coat. Joseph had people bowing to him, just not his brothers like God's dream promised. He received a new pagan name, not a new name from God, which is the way it worked with the patriarchs. Remember Abraham and even his father Jacob, who became Israel. He married a wife who was the daughter of a pagan priest. And so if we take off our Hollywood glasses for a moment, we will see that all the earthly successes of chapter 41 are not Joseph's big payoff. It's not the climax of the story. In fact, his newfound success is providing a massive temptation for Joseph to walk away from God. And so again, we ask, how will he handle it? And I ask you, how will you handle success? More importantly, as you climb the ladder of success, is it God's ladder? Let's see what we can learn from Joseph. We're going to look at and frame our thoughts today around 4 rungs on God's ladder of success from Genesis 41. We're going to pick things up in verse 37. And remember, Joseph has just given Pharaoh his proposal for saving food during the 7 years of plenty so he can provide it for the 7 years of famine. This proposal pleased Pharaoh and all his servants. And Pharaoh said to his servants, "Can we find a man like this in whom is the Spirit of God?" Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has shown you all this, there is none so discerning and wise as you are. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall order themselves as you command. Only I, in regards to the throne, will be greater than you." So check this out. Here's the first rung of God's ladder of success. It's purity over pedigree. If you're taking notes today, would you underline that little phrase in verse 38 where he says, "In whom is the Spirit of God?" and just write purity over pedigree in the margin. Now, notice here that Joseph meets none of the qualifications for the job of second in command in Egypt. He doesn't have the job training. He doesn't have prior experience. He's not even the right nationality or religion. He doesn't make any sense for this role. And yet God puts him in a position of influence and leadership that he would have never imagined just a few days ago. But look at what Pharaoh, this pagan ruler, lists as the important components of Joseph's resume. He says, 1, the Spirit of God is in him. 2, he has discernment. 3, he has wisdom. Notice these are all spiritual qualities. They all come from a deep and abiding relationship with God. Do those 3 things describe you, for example? See, Joseph could have thrown up his hands and he said, "You know what? I don't have what it takes to be in this role. I don't have the pedigree." But God doesn't often give us assignments based on our pedigree, but on our purity. Have you ever turned down an assignment from God because you didn't think you were qualified? I've heard John Maxwell say many times that if he had to identify the number one misconception people have about leadership, it would be the belief that leadership comes from having a position or a title. He calls it the position myth. That says that if you can't lead if you don't have the right position. But success is not about what title you hold. It's about your positive impact on others. And anyone can do that. It's about your purity and not your pedigree. It's one of the reasons that I love this event that's coming up, the Global Leadership Summit that we host here in August. There's a tagline with this event that says, lead where you are. See, the assumption is that I have and that many have is that if you're a Christian, then you're a leader. Because if leadership is influence, then every Christian is called to influence others. Every Christian is a leader, whether it's a coworker, whether it's a neighbor, whether it's your ministry team at church, your kids at home. Lead where you are. We're all called to influence. And if we get better at our leadership, well, then everyone around us wins. You don't have to be a CEO or in a management position to be a leader. If you get better as a mom, guess what? Your family wins. And so if you haven't yet, would you please register for the summit? You can use this code, PHS17TEAM, when you register for this incredible Grace Church discount price that you get. But I want to remind you, you're a leader, so lead where you are. This goes with the first rung that we see here on God's ladder of success. That's purity over pedigree. Look at verse 41. We'll pick up the story. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I have set you over all the land of Egypt. And then Pharaoh took his signet ring from his hand and put it on Joseph's hand. And he clothed him in garments of fine linen and put a gold chain about his neck. And he made him ride in the second chariot. And they called out before him, bow the knee. Can you see all the allusions now to Joseph's former life and his dreams from God? Thus he set Joseph over all the land of Egypt. Moreover, Pharaoh said to Joseph, I am Pharaoh, and without your consent, no one shall lift up a hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zephanath-Paneah, and he gave him in marriage Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. And so Joseph went out over the land of Egypt. And Joseph was 30 years old when he entered the service of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh, and he went through all the land of Egypt. And during the 7 plentiful years, the earth produced abundantly. And he gathered up all the food of these 7 years, which occurred in the land of Egypt. And he put the food in the cities. And he put in every city the food from the fields around it. And here we see the second rung of God's ladder of success. It's that servanthood over selfishness. If you're taking notes today, would you underline the phrase in verse 48 that says, put the food in the cities and just write service over selfishness. This is a good sign that Joseph is not giving in to the corrupting powers of success. I mean, how many times have you seen it that somebody gets a little power and all of a sudden that they're only looking out for themselves and they ignore everyone else? No, we see here Joseph is staying true to his mission to help people survive. I mean, he could have easily let this newfound fame and fortune go to his head, but he used his influence to serve the greater good and ultimately to serve God's people from extinction. He's going out into the cities. He's collecting the food. He's putting it back in the cities. And we're reminded in Joseph's actions that in God's economy, success is always connected to servanthood. The Bible's chock full of examples of this, but the ultimate example is Jesus himself. He came not to be served, remember, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom. In fact, in the Bible, success is always connected to servanthood. Jesus said these words to his disciples in Mark 10. He said, you know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be the slave of all. See, greatness is connected to servanthood. And why is that so hard? It's hard. Because everything in our world, in our Egypt, if you will, is set up to tempt us away from that approach. I mean, let's go back to our great leader, Jesus, and just look at how Satan tempted Jesus in the wilderness at the beginning of his ministry. We can see clearly through this temptation some of the temptations for leaders that will come to us all when we start experiencing some success. In fact, you can flip over to Matthew 4. That's where this story is to see some of this. But I'm just going to summarize it real quickly. The first temptation that Satan brings to Jesus is the temptation towards self-sufficiency. Satan says at the end of Jesus' 40 days fast, remember, imagine 40 days without food. Satan says, just take matters into your own hands and why don't you make some bread out of those stones? See, in times of success, we can become dependent on our own abilities and less dependent on the Lord. Jesus refuses. Satan comes at him with this second temptation. He says, put on a show. He says, throw yourself from the temple and let the angels catch you. Everyone's going to be really impressed. See, during success, we're tempted to become larger than life and to make people think that we're something special. The third temptation he brings his way is power. Satan comes and he promises Jesus all the kingdoms of the earth if Jesus would only worship Satan. We must resist the urge to push and manipulate and control when things are going well with us. And Jesus rebuffed all of these temptations, and so must we, because they will come to us when we are experiencing success. What about you? When things take a turn for the better financially for you, do you get greedy or generous? When things take a turn for the better in terms of extra time for you, do you use it selfishly or in service to others? I mean, I'd be remiss right here if I didn't mention some of the Grace folks who are living this out as we approach the Serve Erie School project this week. I mean, Lisa Holman and Josh Jager and Loretta Nelson and Jess and Pete and Katie Gray and Sue Fawcett and Rosa Gerber. These guys are living examples of servanthood over selfishness. They could have used their time and energy and talents 100 other ways, but they've given it, invested it, so that when you and I show up at Erie High School this week to serve, that we can just step in and go. They've been working for months. Servanthood over selfishness. And so Joseph shows us that on God's ladder of success, purity is more important than pedigree. Servanthood more than selfishness. Let's pick up the story in verse 49. And Joseph stored up grain in great abundance, like the sand of the sea, until he ceased to measure it, for it could not be measured. Before the year of famine came, two sons were born to Joseph. Aseneth, the daughter of Potipharah, the priest of On, bore them to him. And Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh. For he said, God has made me forget all my hardship and all my father's house. And the name of the second he called Ephraim, for God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. Here's the third rung in God's ladder of success. Faith, bold faith over blending in. Now, this is a really critical moment in our narrative. Remember, Joseph's been given a pagan name. He's been forced to marry a pagan wife. And we're left wondering, is he just starting to blend in? Is he compromising his faith? Has he gotten sucked into the idol worship of Egypt? But the naming of his children is an important glimmer of hope during his years in Egypt. Here's why. He gave his kids Hebrew names. And that's a big deal. In fact, you can underline the kids' names there, Manasseh and Ephraim in verses 51 and 52. And just write bold faith over blending in. This was a radical and gutsy move on the part of Joseph. Remember, his master, his wife, his in-laws, his entire world from age 17 to now in his mid-30s. Actually, he'd be 37 if this is at the end of the 7 year years of plenty. He was Egyptian. But so now, after some 20 years away from home, he finally has a chance to make a clear declaration of his allegiance. And he chooses God. And the naming of his kids. He has the finest clothes. He has jewels, chariots, houses. He has the best food in the land of the Nile that it has to offer. He has the finest entertainment. He's living a life of opulent wealth beyond anything that he could have ever dreamed of experiencing as the son of a shepherd. He could have just blended in, not rocked the boat, given his kids some safe Egyptian names. However, he boldly declares, I'm with God. And my kids are with God. Now look at those names for a minute. Manasseh means to forget. He's saying, I forget all my hardship. He's declaring that he's not going to be defined by his past. He's moving forward. And we're going to look at this much more next week. But the wording can be confusing. But he's not abandoning his family. We're going to learn that in just a few chapters. But He's abandoning what was done to him by his brothers. He's moving on from that. Do you know that it's possible to move on from things that we will never get over? That's going to take a minute to set in, but it's true. And that's what Joseph is declaring here. When he names his second son Ephraim, which means fruitful, the order of the children is important here because we must forget the past before we become fruitful. But then in Joseph's description of the name, he issues this bold and really flat-out rejection of Egypt, his current land of prosperity. Notice what he called it there in verse 52. He said, "This is my land of affliction." He's clearly declaring that no matter how good or bad things get in Egypt, he's saying, I'm the Lord's, and the Lord is mine. And so I ask you, when things are going your way, do you just blend in and not rock the boat? You know, maybe you get that promotion at work, but there's still some really shady stuff going on. Do you just let it slide, or do you call it out? Maybe you finally met that special someone, but every time you're with them, you find yourself compromising your values. Do you stand up for what you believe in, or do you cave in? What happens in your success? Joseph declared that all the success, all the wealth, all the good times, it's all a land of affliction compared to knowing God and doing His will. Peter in the New Testament describes it this way in his letter. He says, we're strangers and aliens in this world. That our primary citizenship is in another place. And so no matter how good it gets for us here, the world is still our land of affliction compared to our place in heaven, our citizenship there. So we've learned that God's ladder of success includes purity over pedigree, servanthood instead of selfishness, bold faith and not blending in. And so let's pick things up in verse 53. The 7 years of plenty that occurred in the land of Egypt came to an end, and the 7 years of famine began to come, and as Joseph had said. And there was famine in all the lands, but in the land of Egypt there was bread. And when all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried out to Pharaoh for bread. Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, go to Joseph. What he says to you, do. And so when the famine had spread over all the land, Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe in the land of Egypt. Moreover, all the earth came to Egypt, to Joseph, to buy grain, because the famine was severe over all the earth. Here's the fourth rung on God's ladder of success. It's just big picture over big promotions. The key to this whole story comes in the very last verse of chapter 41. If you're taking notes, will you underline this little crucial phrase? All the earth came to Egypt, and simply write big picture over big promotions. You see, God sent Joseph to Egypt. He arranged his steps to finally land in Egypt, not to become personally rich and powerful, though that happened. The reason he sent him there was to preserve the covenant and to rescue God's people. As the rest of this story plays out, it ends up that all Joseph went through wasn't to make him the center of the universe. There were 70 family members who are about to be spared from famine, who will eventually become a great nation called Israel. And out of them would come one who is called the Messiah, also known as Jesus Christ. And many of us in this very room have been rescued by him. We have called on the name of the Lord, as the Bible says, and we have been saved by him. And so Joseph's success was not all about his personal acclaim. It was about his family. It was about his nation. It was about a Messiah. It was about you and me. Think about what would have happened to you and me if Joseph had gotten caught up in his big promotion and had forgotten about the big picture. It's a profound lesson for all of us. Here's what you need to remember. If you're successful, it's not all about you. There's a bigger picture at work. There are other people to consider. With success comes great responsibility before God. In fact, I'll say it this way. Earthly success shouldn't just give us joy. It should give us pause. It should cause us to ask questions. Is this from God? If so, why is God entrusting me with this? Where is His bigger picture at work? How is God asking me to share my resources, my time, my energy with other people to expand His kingdom? We need to take pause and ask these kinds of questions and then do our part in God's grand story. You see, we get this wrong all the time, but you and I are the supporting cast in the story that God is writing in this world. And whenever we start acting like we're the star, things get weird for us and everybody around us. But it's so tempting, isn't it? It's so tempting to put ourselves in the center of every situation, to try to make ourselves the hero of every story and everyone else the villain. But it's not about you, including and maybe especially in your success. And so we must ask, what does God want to do through me in this new position? What does He want to do through me in this new promotion, in this new opportunity? How might God want me to use this new car, this new home, this new purchase for His purposes? How might God want to be glorified in this new relationship, this new ministry, this new time I'm spending with my neighbor? You see, your success is not about promoting yourself. It's God's story. It's about promoting Him. So here's my hope for you today, that God would instill in you His definition of success. That instead of climbing all the other ladders that we climb, as defined by our career, as defined by your relationships, your family, that God's definition would win the day, that you would turn your attention to His ladder of success, because His is the only one that counts. And as we conclude today, as a next step, I would just like to ask you to look at these rungs today in table form, kind of compare and contrast of the world's definition of success and God's definition of success. And I want you to pick one of those rungs that you need to surrender to God. One of those areas that you may be more inclined to be kind of in the left column versus the right column. And as this table is kind of up on the screen today, I'd just love you to spend these last few minutes confessing and entrusting yourself to His will and to His definition of success. God bless you.